Welcome to the Word Theater Short Story Podcast, your weekly access to the best short stories read by great actors, recorded live in the US and the UK. My name is Cedaring Fox. I am Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Pitt, UK founder and creative partner. It's been such a pleasure so far to share these stories from our archive with audiences across the globe, and we need your support to keep us going. So please leave us a review, recommend us to your friends, and check out our website, wordtheatre.org, to learn how to become an annual member.
Today we have two gorgeous stories by Simon Van Bui, and they're read by two wonderful actors. Ian Hart will perform a story titled Distant Ships, and then John Tenney will perform a story called Save As Many As You Ruin. If you happen to be in London on Saturday evening, October 16th, 2021, you can see Ian Hart at a live Word Theatre performance. We're in person at the Crazy Cox, and you can find all the information about it on our website at wordtheatre.org. Here to introduce his story, Distant Ships, please welcome Simon Van Bui.
Hello, my name is Simon Van Bui, and I'm the author of Distant Ships. That story came about through the real desire to connect with somebody I read about in the newspaper who died in a tragic way. They'd starved to death in the empty body of a submarine somewhere near Russia. So that day I went to the beach and I saw a man sitting by the water in his early 50s, who was reluctant to go in. He looked quite athletic, but there was a fear. And somehow I connected this man to what I'd read in the New York Times about this person perishing in the submarine. And then that connected to something in my life. And the magic of a short story is that you're holding hands with many different people at once. You're holding hands with the people who've inspired the story, the people in your past with whom you have unresolved conflict, and then the people who will read the story and carry it through their own emotional processes. So that's really how that came about. And I always believe in writing the bones of a short story from start to finish. So I went home from the beach, Jones Beach in New York, to my desk and wrote this from start to finish. And by the end of a story, if you're weeping, you know it's going to be okay.
I think of Leo very often these days. I think of him tonight as I sort packages for a truck that's headed for London. It is so cold in the warehouse that we wear our breaths like beards. The office sent down a box of gloves last week, but I enjoy the feel of cardboard against my old cracked hands. I have worked for the Royal Mail for almost 3 decades now. I thought they'd let me go when I stopped speaking 20 years ago. But they've been good to me, and when I retire in 10 years, I'll be given a state pension and a humble send-off. I enjoy my work. It's the only reason I leave the house, except for my walks along the beach. Each package has somewhere to go, and the contents remain a mystery. So occasionally I'll find a box with the addresses being written by a child. So I used to put these boxes to one side until the end of my shift, so I could study the penmanship and compare it to Leo's. In a child's handwriting, language is exposed as the pained and crooked medium it really is. Since losing Leo, these packages are like shards of glass. The warehouse is divided into sections and there are no windows, and sometimes I imagine the factory is in Oslo or Mumbai or Rotterdam. Outside, the sopping Welsh hillside roll away in one direction like giants under blankets of moss. On the other direction, the land suddenly stops as though woken up. Where the land stops, something else begins, and the sea stretches north until it starts to freeze, and then it clings to the earth like a child to its mother. Small muddy vans roll in from the villages and the valleys, and these vans are unloaded and the packages are sorted by the nearest city. And every 2 days, hulking great lorries chug from the warehouses to Glasgow, Manchester, London, Penzance. As I walk home each morning in the dark, I picture headlights carving through night's flesh. I love the names of the towns on the packages, the same way I love the different species of weeds that blindly push through the shell of earth around the fork gate of my house. Hundreds of years ago, the village relied solely on fishing. I have a book of paintings in my sitting room at home, and one of the paintings has young women in aprons, standing on cliffs, watching a ship get smashed against the rocks. In the foreground is an arm of sunlight reaching down to the surface of the sea. Now, I couldn't tell you who painted the picture, but I understand the inclusion of that long beam of light. I understand the grief that makes such details necessary. There is little fishing work in the town now. Although the warehouse provides more of a steady income than fishing, all the boys in the village, they dream of going to sea. They dream with their windows open of ancestors on the sort of ship you see now only in bottles. Sometimes I walk along the rocky beach beneath the village. The dark green water seeps in, and I scream with the roar of dragging rocks. I spend hours peering into rock pools at fish and crabs, and I wonder, do they know they've been cut off? I sit on the cold pebbles until the tide sloshes over my shoes and my water soaks through my socks and pulls at my toes like some hysterical being. When early morning comes and my shift ends, I write down the number of vans that I have unloaded. After 30 years, I've never made a mistake, because for me, each truck is like a person. See, as a boy, I always felt that our vehicles had faces. I clock out and I find my coat in the break room, and there's a half-eaten sandwich on the table. There's a calendar of topless women hanging from one of the lockers. The women look cold, but they wear large smiles. Perhaps photographs can fake happiness, but never grief. The warehouse is half an hour's walk from the village, so first I go through the country of a narrow lane and then up a hill into town past hedgerows, thick with birds peering out from their nests, and in summer, wild berries replace the black eyes of the birds. In a few hours, dawn will flood the world. I stop walking, and I lean against a lamppost. My left leg always hurts, and it's worse in winter. Everything is worse around Christmas. The light from the street lamp falls upon my hands. They are the colour of stained glass. In the village church, there is a magnificent stained glass window, and sometimes I kneel beneath it and drown in colour. When the pain in my leg is back to a dull throbbing, I continue walking. Stones caught in the tracks of my boots scrape against the concrete. I miss autumn, the season when summer takes on the memory of its own mortality, and then winter, and then the miracle season, when everything begins again, fearlessly. The walk home is always slow, and rows of slate houses glisten, their black foreheads are white with tomorrow's breath. Curtains are pulled across the eyes from within. A bird hops around a lamppost. There is a plump worm in his beak. Flies away as I approach. I pass the corner pub, and even though it's against the law, pubs in the village are open all the time on account of the few remaining fishermen who return an hour or so before dawn, with a thirst built up from being on the water without being able to drink any of it. The light spills out of the street with the sound of laughing. I smell beer, and a dull thud from the jukebox reminds me of my leg, which reminds me of Leo. A mist wraps around the town, its white arms spread through the streets. Dogs bark at kitchen windows. I used to go into the pub for a pint or two, but I haven't been in for about 6 years. It's all so useless. After Jean took Leo's things to America 20 years ago, I felt a sense of relief. The house was quiet, and for some reason I began to think about my mother who had died when she was 86. Same year, Jean and I were married. My mother slipped on some ice and broke her hip, and then, without warning, she died in hospital. It was like closing of a book I never thought would end. I spent last Sunday watching fishing boats chug home, their hulls thick with silver pellets of fish. I haven't said a word in 20 years. There was a time when you couldn't shut me up. I've lived so long without the pain of language. My life is a letter with no address. If you were to watch me for an afternoon, you'd notice that my hands are always moving, like blind siblings that are always touching one another. I like watching the fishing boats, and each boat's arrival is celebrated by a spray of birds. Seagulls from a distance look like eyes drifting across the waves. Last week, one of the young captains asked me if I needed work. I shook my head. He was a handsome boy, probably about the age Leo could have been. I wonder who has inherited the life Leo left behind. I live in the house I grew up in. My parents' room is the same. It's the guest room. The only guests are ghosts who drift in through doorways in dreams. Everybody in the village knows my life, but I'm too old to think that my sadness is special. Jean is my age, but lives a different life. In this village with its damp shoes and Sunday hymns, you are old the moment someone you love dies. And then Sundays are spent watching light move across the garden from small hot rooms that smell like ironing. Jean lives in Los Angeles. We're still married, though we haven't spoken since Leo. I think they make pictures in Los Angeles. Perhaps her life is one long fantasy. Sometimes I linger outside the junior school at the bottom of the hill. At this time of year, Christmas decorations are hanging in the windows, and beyond the school are the mountains, dotted with sheep and the odd light of a tractor grinding its way home. Sometimes I time my walks to coincide with the 3 o'clock school bell, and children gush into the playground like hot water, into the arms of their parents. I would give everything, every memory, especially memory, if I could hold Leo again. The weight of his absence is the weight of the entire world. I stopped speaking soon after the accident, in the hope that I'd retain the memory of his soft, lispy voice. Sometimes I cup one of Leo's words in my hands like a trembling bird. After the accident, the doctor said I only had a few months to live. Jean went back to America, and I waited for the journey home. I felt like packing a suitcase, but I didn't know what to put into it. That was 20 years ago. I stopped going to doctors. They only believe in what they think they know. They're like priests, blinded from spirituality by religion. Jean would be shocked if she could see how bleak everything is, though the village hasn't really changed, except for cars are now allowed in the marketplace, and there's a link road now for lorries through the mountains. When I thought I was going to die after the accident, I started writing a book, and then I never stopped writing. It is called Dreams Are Lost Cities of Childhood. I worked on it every day for 20 years. I will not be finished until I'm dead. The book I'm writing is a book to end all books. My death will be the concluding chapter. I have drawn all the pictures too. The book is about my life with Leo and Jean. I cannot draw myself, so I mark my body in the pictures with an X. Sometimes when I read old chapters, I'm suddenly in the midst of how things were. Like being on a theatre set that someone has built of your life. Memories like life, but with actors. Jean wakes up to sunshine. She drinks orange juice. Los Angeles is warm, even at this time of year. Leo would be a man now. Some people have Christmas on the beach in America. They do in Australia too. I wake up to wet rain, tapping on my window like 100 Welsh mothers. Each drop is a note on a minor scale. Jean came here to study climate. There's a university in Bangor. See, students come from across the world to watch clouds. I remember her watching with marvel the slow, swirling explosions of white. I offered her a cup of cockles. That was when you could buy them from a cart, but it's long since gone now. It was where the old people would talk about the war. Jean's accent was smooth and rich. I used to wish my ancestors had gone to America. And perhaps things would be different, you know, perhaps we could have met at a cinema, at a drive-in. Perhaps Leo and I would have worked on an old car together, you know, the sort of people building their garages. 20 years ago, I drove off the side of our cliff. I was trying to make Leo laugh, you know, by turning around and make faces. It's as simple as that. Leo's body was recovered half a mile from the wreckage. It looked as though he were asleep, but his insides were liquid. I like to think he was carried away from the car by angels. The same angels that drifted out of the stories I've grown fond of reading by Milton and Blake. They rode beneath the same moon that's above the village. Everything that's ever happened, the moon saw. They tell me I survived the accident. It's Wednesday morning. Darkness at this hour is seldom remembered. Most people are about to wake up. I stand lopsided outside my front door. It's not really a door, but another gateway to sadness. It begins to drizzle, and the fog rolls away and creeps up the black hillside. Fires are being lit. Mornings in Wales reek of frying eggs and wood smoke. Children are stirring in warm beds. Soon they will be released from the arms of dreams. All dreams are envoys of God. It is night here, but day somewhere else, and somehow it keeps on going and going, whether you're part of it or not. Suddenly the sky is full of rain. Drops the size of your thumbs. It will soon be Christmas. The children at school are putting on a play. They make their own costumes. Night is a tattered veil suspended. The moon is full and absent all at once. Leo's face waits for me in every mirror. Dreams are unfinished wings of our soul.
To introduce Save As Many As You Ruin, read by John Tenney, please welcome once again the author, Simon Van Bui.
This story I wrote because I had unresolved conflict with somebody in my life. And a lot of short stories come about because they're emotional knots which are holding you back in some way. So writing enables the author to undergo a kind of emotional catharsis while connecting to other people who might also be living in the same sort of prison. But of course, a lot of the emotional prisons we live in don't have any locks or jailers or even doors, except that we can't find our way out. So sometimes you read a story or you write a story and you find yourself suddenly emancipated.
By the time Gerard leaves his office, it has stopped snowing. Lights are coming on, but it's not yet dark. At the end of each block, the sidewalk disappears under a pool of gray ice water. Gerard thinks of everyone's footprints in the snow. Manhattan was once a forest. He imagines the footprints of an Indian slipping home, on his shoulders a warm carcass with clumps of snow stuck to its fur. Gerard thinks of his own footprints and how soon they will disappear. He exhales into the world and his breath disappears. He recalls Rilke. What is ours floats into the air like steam from a dish of hot food. He wonders if his life is an extraordinary one. Gerard remembers the freezing cross-country races at his English prep school, bare white legs spotted with mud, plum-sized hearts thumping. He remembers Hetherington, the physical education teacher, his strong jaw and sweet blue eyes, the desire to see his boys drink up the glory of victory. Hetherington ran in the 1936 Olympics in Berlin. He won a medal. Hitler watched. Millions were about to be killed as a teenage Hetherington crossed the finish line. A few years later, children walked into gas ovens after a long journey from home. They were scared but trusted their parents. Gerard feels stabbing love for his daughter. He crosses 53rd Street. Her name is Lucy, and she is 8. She has short brown hair with Hello Kitty clips pinned cleanly to her head. Gerard once sat next to a rabbi on the train to Southampton. The rabbi had just returned from England. He was making a documentary about the war. "But there are so many already," Gerard had said. Walking up Fifth Avenue, he cringes at the insensitivity of his comment. "He must have thought I was like everyone else," he thinks. "Am I like everyone else?" he thinks. The rabbi had merely put his hand on Gerard's cuff for a moment. It suddenly begins snowing again. Yellow taxis are nodding through the snowy dusk. The lights from shop windows are beckoning. Gerard thinks of the mannequins. They're very still, perfectly still. They're talking about something they've never done. They're sitting down to meals they'll never eat, tucked into beds in which they'll never dream. He pictures Lucy in their warm apartment, perched at the table, reading A Simplified Black Beauty in large print, her legs swinging under the table in concentration. He has never known such devotion. Gerard is handsome. He slept with many women. Most knew he would never love them, so they kept a distance, sparing themselves the grief of an ancient pain. Gerard loved one woman once, but not Lucy's mother. Lucy is at home with Indira, a heavy-set Barnard student from New Delhi who cooks dinner every weeknight and helps Lucy with her homework. Gerard and Lucy love Indian food. Indira often stays and eats with them. At first, she wouldn't. She's becoming part of the family. Her father died. The snow is covering everything. Gerard remembers The Invisible Man, a crackling film from the 1930s. He watched it one night with Lucy. She'd seen it listed in TV Guide and wanted to watch it. It was on late. She fell asleep after 5 minutes. Gerard could feel her heart thudding like a soft, warm rock. As he carried her to bed, she asked him what happened to the Invisible Man. Gerard told her that he was caught because it began to snow, and he left footprints. "That's beautiful," she said, without opening her eyes. "It's a blizzard now. Flakes like clumps of fur ripped from winter's back. And then he sees Laurel through the falling snow. 8 years have passed. He can't believe it. He stops walking. A woman with bags bumps into him and curses. Laurel is a few feet away. He steps over to the glass and taps gently on it. A line of people inside the shop turn to face him like a sleepy jury. Her face is still sharp and angular like a cubist painting, but softened now by her eyes, which have sunk or regressed partly into memory. He thinks she is more beautiful than ever. Her mouth opens in the shape of an almond. Gerard cannot tell if she is smiling. All this happens within 5 seconds. Gerard wonders if he's done the right thing. Perhaps he should have walked on, Later at home in his study, he could recreate the moment he saw her in line at the shop and let the memory spill over like a faucet left running. She's holding a tray of raw fish and a bottle of iced tea. In that moment of recognition, he's not consumed by a rushing sensation of love. Quite simply, a door opens to a room that has never gone away. The years apart were just years without one another. They were together only a few months. They met at a dinner party given by one of Girard's colleagues. There were candles and wine, and the women wore dresses that left their shoulders bare. The candles made their shoulders glisten. Even unattractive women have beautiful shoulders. He and Laurel talked for hours. He felt as if they were catching up, though they'd never met. When he finds her in the line, she's about to pay, but Girard quickly hands the cashier a few bills. Laurel blushes. "I can't believe it's you," she says. "I know," he says, and tries to maintain eye contact, but people are pushing past. "So how are you?" she says. "Fine," he says. "And you?" "Good," she says. "How is your daughter?" "She's wonderful. She's wonderful." "How is her mother?" Girard pauses. "Dead," he says. "Are you kidding?" "No." "Oh my God." Laurel is genuinely shocked. Now, when Lucy was 6 months old, Issy went back to Los Angeles to fulfill her ambition of becoming an actress, Girard said. "What? She left her child?" 4 years later, she died. Still felt uncomfortable to say her name in front of Laurel. "That's crazy," Laurel says. "Really crazy." "But that she died?" Girard asks. "Well, yeah, that, but for a mother to leave her child." "It was what she did." "I know, but it's crazy." "Yeah. What, did she ever visit?" "No." "Wow. I'm sorry, Girard." "It's okay. Lucy has no memory of it." "But she was still her mother." "Sure. Does she know?" "No. I'll tell her when she's older, in high school, maybe. I can't bring myself to hurt her with the truth now. Something like that can destroy a child." "You're still kind," she says. "I love her. I'm her father. I want what's best for her." "You were kind to me, too." "Was I?" Girard says. I don't feel as if I was." "You were," she says, "despite everything." Girard went to Issy's funeral in Los Angeles 4 years ago. She was found floating in a pool. She'd written Girard's name as her next of kin. Los Angeles was 75 degrees and dry. The air conditioning in his rental car smelled like candy. Issy had played a part of a psychic on a soap opera. People exchanged business cards at the buffet after the cremation. Girard told Lucy he had to visit Hollywood on business. She wanted to come, and Indira offered to sleep over and did. Girard brought Lucy a present back. He wanted to buy many, but stopped himself. He didn't want L.A. to have a special significance. He brought Indira a gift, too, a tote bag from Mocha with little birds on it and French writing. Lucy had asked about her mother recently. Girard didn't know what to say. He was planning on going to a child psychologist to ask for advice. Girard met Issy a month after he met Laurel. A decade ago, Girard had never met any of them. Girard vaguely remembers the feeling of being in love with Laurel and the desire to have sex with Issy. He knew that other men enjoyed the occasional partner outside of long-term relationships, and he wanted to try it. And Issy was an incredible lover. She sprayed perfume on her thighs. She was uninhibited and never took her heels off, even after. Issy wasn't upset when Gerard told her that he was falling in love with Laurel. She laughed. And then she cried and told him she was pregnant. Gerard thought it was a joke. She was always telling lies. And then he felt something crack inside him because she wouldn't stop crying. And he knew it was true. He told Laurel the next night, and she said she understood. And a week later, Laurel broke it off in an email. Gerard agreed to move in with Issy. Gerard still has Laurel's wristwatch at home in his bedside cabinet. She left it in his apartment 8 years ago. Miraculously, the battery still works. Sometimes at night, Gerard takes it out and falls asleep as it drips from his fingers. Laurel is 43 now. She's a senior editor of business books. She had a cat, but it died. Gerard buys some coffee and asks if they can walk together. Of course, she says, and then she looks outside at the blizzard and laughs. She's wearing the same kind of heels Issy used to wear. As they leave the deli, there are people getting out of a taxi. Quick, Gerard says, and they get in. In the cab, they talk about the president, their parents, and Laurel's brief marriage. She's divorced now, and her ex-husband is living with another man in Brooklyn Heights. Now, she laughs, but Gerard can see she's disappointed. When they get to her building, Gerard's nose starts bleeding. Night has fallen upon the city, but the snow isn't stopping. Oh my God, Laurel says and tips Gerard's head back. And people watch them. Jesus, come inside, okay? She says to Gerard. Okay, he says. In the elevator, they talk about their jobs. He can feel the blood clotting in his nose. Tiny fragments of snow have lodged in Laurel's eyelashes. Upstairs, Gerard calls Indira to say he'll be back a little later. And then he and Laurel make love. First in the kitchen, and then in her bed. Her body is not as he remembers it. It's softer and somehow more pliable. Her toes seem perfect. Her apartment smells of expensive scented candles. She makes coffee after. Her furniture is modern and gray, and he feels somehow inside of her, held by her. And he remembers as a boy swimming to the bottom of a thick pond in summer. When he arrives home, Lucy jumps down from her chair and runs into his arms. Gerard kneels and her weight becomes his. Why aren't you in bed, Pebble? Gerard says. And Indira appears in the doorway. School is canceled tomorrow because of the snow, so I didn't think you'd mind if she waited up. Oh, of course, Indira, it's perfectly fine. Why are you so late, Daddy? She's kissing him all over his face. Gerard imagines her mother floating in the pool. I love you, he says. I love you too, Daddy. But where were you? I met an old friend and we had dinner, he says. Lucy can smell a lie a mile off. Is your old friend an old woman? Lucy asks. Yes. How did you know? Gerard laughs. A daughter knows, she says, and runs back to the table laughing and flailing her arms as though they were about to become wings. Indira won't stay, so Gerard gives her more than enough cab money and thanks her for staying late. She kisses him on the cheek, and he holds her. Her hair smells of onions. After a bedtime story, Lucy asks if she can meet her father's friend. I think that would be nice, Gerard says. Lucy looks shocked, as if she'd expected him to say no. Children are difficult to read sometimes. Does she like ice cream? Lucy asks. Yes, she eats it every day. Are you going to marry her? Gerard pauses. Wait and see. Does she have any children my age? I don't think so. Do you want her to? I don't think so. Oh, only if they're not boys. She asks her father to sit on the edge of her bed until she falls asleep. He says yes, as always. But falls asleep first, as always. Soon they are both asleep. The snow is blowing against the window. The room glows with the breath of streetlight. Around midnight, Gerard wakes up. Lucy stirs. Daddy, where's Panda? Gerard finds her stuffed panda and lays it next to her. She goes back to sleep immediately. In the kitchen, Gerard pours himself half a tumbler of whiskey, turns out the lights in the apartment, he checks the front door, and then walks barefoot into his study. Instead of taking down a book from the shelf, he looks out the window. He can see all the way up Lexington Avenue. The snow is drifting across the city in waves. Traffic is thin. A few glowing eyes. He knows that before long, Laurel will move in with them. He thinks of Issy. He remembers her laugh. Then the roar of snapping flames at her cremation. All of a sudden, he feels a chill like cold water down his back. The tumbler of scotch slips from his fingers and shatters on the floor. Gerard spins around. His heart leaps into his throat. Someone was there. He could have sworn it. But in the space between him and the world, he can see only air. Only air and the auras of the day past and the day to come. He thinks how strange life is, with its frayed edges and second chances. And though by morning he will have forgotten that he ever thought it, Gerard feels as though he is being followed, and there are voices he can't hear, that the footsteps of snow on the window are just that. And like Lucy's conception, life is a string of guided and subtle explosions.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to these wonderful actors, Ian Hart and John Tenney, performing stories by Simon Vambui. If you like our podcast, please support Word Theater and our authors by purchasing their books at bookshop.org/shop/wordtheater. And be sure to visit our website. You'll learn all about the upcoming show in London and learn how to become a contributing member. We want you to join our community. We are trying to make a better world, one story at a time, and we need your support.
Thank you, Jonathan Sachs, for composing our theme music, and Joseph Cho, our technical director. This is Kirsty Pitt in England.
And I'm Cedaring Fox, also in England, currently in London, on the way up north to our writer's workshop. Until next week, signing off.